Sure.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. This week in book news, Palestinian author Adania Shibley's novel Minor Detail, which is about the well-documented 1949 rape and murder of a Bedouin girl by Israeli soldiers, was scheduled to receive a prize at the Frankfurt Book Fair in Germany. Last week, the program organizers canceled the ceremony as well as a public discussion with Shibley and her translator, Günther Orth. The organizers claimed that this was done with Shibley's consent, and the New York Times had reported their claims without verifying with Shibley, but it was not true. Shibley had not been given a choice. Arab Lit and Lit Hub have published an open letter in support of Adania Shibley and other Palestinian writers that includes the signatures of over 350 authors, publishers, translators, literary agents, and literary voices.
So if you have not read Minor Detail, we very much recommend it, along with, if you can find a copy, an anthology of short stories by Palestinian women called Kasat. It's edited by Joe Glanville and any other Palestinian authors. You can find, there's some free downloads of books about Palestine and by Palestinians at Haymarket. And if you live in the United States, please call your representatives quickly and frequently to let them know that you support a ceasefire in Gaza. We absolutely understand that a ceasefire is a temporary solution to a much larger crisis. We have included some tools and action items from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, as well as Jewish Voices for Peace, in our show notes that can help you with this. We here at the bookstore fully believe that we cannot allow Palestinian voices to be silenced. Now, there's no way to do a good transition from something that is really serious and something that's very much like it's so important to us. We're going to talk about a book that is kind of silly.
Definitely so in comparison. Yeah.
I just feel like I need to apologize. There's going to be a very severe tone shift coming up. I don't know what else to say, but it is going to be awkward and weird what we're going to be transitioning into.
Yes.
So.
Right. For, let's see, this month's bookstore challenge was to read a book that takes place in another dimension or on another planet. Becca's pick that we read today is Babel 17. I would pronounce it Babel, but the narrator of the book pronounced it Babel. I don't know what that's all about. By Samuel R. Delaney. The next book we will be reading, because October is a three-book month, is The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. That was chosen by our Patreon members over at patreon.com/thebookstore. You can check that out. We post different stuff over there. That's all for the monthly challenge update. Next month, well, I guess maybe not. Next month is November. November's challenge is to read a book about death or a disaster. Our first read for that will be Death with Interruptions by Jose Saramago. That's all for that. Content and advisory spoiler warnings for this episode can be found in our show notes, as usual. Spoilers are often unavoidable, and this book is also like 50 years old. So that's, you know, that's just a caution.
That, and I also think that we're going to be trying to figure out what happened in the book. And
certainly,
because of that, naturally, we are going to talk about a lot of plot points.
Yes.
But yeah, so I picked this book. I had read a New Yorker article, a profile of Samuel R. Delaney by Julian Lucas. And I was like, Delaney just seems so fascinating. He seems really interesting, really cool. And I think that his novel Dahlgren, which I guess is, I think it's one of his most popular ones, has been on my TBR. Like, I think I added it as in like a classic sci-fi you should read, you know, that has been on my list for a long time. It's like 800 pages. So I don't think I'm actually going to get to it
ever in my lifetime anyway. You might, I won't.
Babel 17 was like short, so I thought, cool, like it's about language, so that's why I picked it. It's a lot different than what I expected.
This is not a genre that I read a lot. Sometimes I think that I read a lot of science fiction, but then I realize that I don't. I read a lot of probably what is closer to fantasy, and also a lot of the stuff that I think of as science fiction is quite soft. Hard sci-fi. And also, I have come to find out that a lot of people argue about the authors that I like as not being actual science fiction writers. So,
well, I think I thought that too. So I love Dune, and I've read the whole series, not the ones that weren't written by Frank, but the ones written by him. And those are in my head what hard sci-fi is, but I looked it up and they are not considered hard sci-fi at all. They're like eco books or ecological books or soft sci-fi. They're not. So I was like, okay, I don't know really that I've ever read.
At the risk of like offending a lot of sci-fi fans, which like I mean, maybe you're out there listening to this podcast, but my guess is because we don't really do a lot of sci-fi, that maybe we don't have the hardcore sci-fi fans here. But one thing I feel like sci-fi is known for is really being like taxonomic in terms of making those distinctions. So, yeah, this one is a little different than what I was used to, but maybe we should just get into the book description. Do you want me to read it since I wrote it and it's forever long?
Yeah, go ahead. Just because you know how sometimes you stumble over words when you've never read a sentence before?
I do like all these dumb little like run-ons. Anyway, so Babel 17 was written by Samuel R. Delaney, as we mentioned, and published by Ace Books in 1966. In 67, it was the joint winner of the Nebula Award for Best Novel alongside Flowers for Algernon, which is a book that I hate. Rydra Wong, which I at first read incorrectly and thought was like a pun for right a wrong. Which is like, uh-oh, it's that kind of book, but it wasn't. It's just a Rydra Wong is a 26-year-old polyglot spaceship captain, an intergalactically renowned poet. She is sought out by the Alliance forces to help translate messages that have been intercepted from Alliance enemies, known pretty much only as the Invaders. No Alliance member has ever encountered this language. All of their code crackers, etc., haven't been able to figure it out. And the language is known as Babel 17. Rydra Wong is their only hope. I did not do that on purpose, but that does... Yeah, sorry. She's tasked with putting a ragtag ship's crew together and working on transcribing the language while also predicting where the next invader attack will be taking place. So, like, I don't know how they're doing that.
Yeah.
We'll get into that. I don't know how anything in this book works. So, anyway. Some interesting things to note. There is almost kind of like a class system made out of customs people, who are people who work for the Alliance as part of the military, and transport, who are laborers that work on the spaceships. Transport has their own sort of like underground world where people hang out naked at this wrestling party place, and they also can get extreme body modifications. Like one guy is like 10 feet tall and looks like a saber-toothed tiger, kind of, and then like other people can have dragons put into their bodies.
I gotta talk about that,
I guess. But anyway, they go to that's their underground world. We travel through that world with Rydra as she's attempting to collect members for her ship, including a romantic triad known as a triple, whose intense bond and communication skills allow them to successfully navigate the ship. And there's also ship sensors. I don't know if these people are always known as the ear, the eye, and the nose, but at least on this ship, that is what they are called. And they sense where the ship is going by using those senses that correspond to what they are called. And they are particularly sensitive to these senses because they are also discorporate or dead. They're like ghosts, kind of. Mm-hmm. I don't totally know. Anyway, in true space opera fashion, the crew attends like a fancy dinner at the home of this baron who shows off his arsenal of inventive weapons, including a sophisticated humanoid space spy machine. The dinner ends in murder and mayhem. And then as they evade the invaders, the crew are captured by space pirates upon a shadow ship where Rydra falls in love with a criminal whose language doesn't allow him to understand the concepts of you and I. And there's a long bit about them figuring out you and I together. Where do you end and I begin? All that. And mm-hmm. then while Rydra is learning more about Babel 17, it's an incredibly complex language, and it has so much coded into it that those who learn it are kind of able to think at such extremely fast speeds that it essentially allows them to slow their perception of time. And also she's telepathic. And there we go.
So I got a lot of vibes of Diadem from the Stars in this book.
I mean, it is the same era, kind of.
It's the same era. It's the same sort of very deep genre, right? Like, they're not at all trying to appeal to the mainstream. Like, this is for people who like this stuff. And for me, I think I just felt totally lost. I didn't know what was happening, what's going on. Somehow people are just constantly speaking, but nothing is being said.
Incessant dialogue.
It's just, I mean, and I do think this is better than Diadem from the Stars.
I agree.
I think it's better written, and I do think it's, I don't know, I guess a better story, but not quite so offensive either.
It has better themes, and it's like a more interesting concept.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
And there's tropey things that I like. So I mm-hmm. like the trope of let's get this crew together and go to this place and this place and this place and hear their short bio and, you know what I mean, and collect these people. The problem is I didn't understand why she was picking the people she was picking. How does she know these people?
It sometimes felt like somebody that I live with is like watching a movie and I'm like doing chores and I just keep coming in and watching parts of it. But the book was written like that. So it felt like we were missing like huge chunks. They would just be in one place and then the next with like no explanation of where they were going or why. So yeah, that was really disorienting, like from the beginning. They would just be places just out of nowhere with no rhyme or reason.
I'm okay with not everything needs to be explained. So like,
sure,
the customs and the transport, okay, we get this is a class-based society.
Sure.
Like, I don't need super explanation of why this came about, you know, but I do want to know, why are the spaceship workers children?
Yeah.
They keep referring to them as kids. I believe they're teenagers.
Uh-huh.
But, like, why?
Yeah. And so, like, that was my thing with, like, the discorporate. They go to the morgue, I think, to pick out a woman to be... And was she discorporate or was she just... Was she something else?
Well, that's the other thing I didn't understand.
Because as I was reading a review... Sorry. I read a couple of reviews on Tor.com. One of them was by Boji... Takax. I believe they said that they were Hungarian. I apologize if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. And it was for Quilt Bag, Speculative Classics, Babel 17 by Samuel R. Delaney is the title of the review. So I read a couple of them and I'm afraid to like quote them too much on accident. But they said something about how one of the reviews said something about how the ear, eyes and nose were discorporate and they were like ghosts, but they went and picked up the third for the triple and she intentionally chose a woman who spoke a different language than the other two so that they would have to learn like a different way to communicate with each other more mm-hmm. deeply. But she was also one of the people who like chose to die, because in this world people can go if they're depressed and they can basically choose suicide, but it's not really suicide. It's like, it's kind of like a suspended state of being for their body, but also like they are dead in that like their consciousness is just like uploaded to a computer. So they're not really alive, but also they are, but they're not, I guess.
Which is an interesting idea for a sci-fi.
yeah,
thing but to my... be, especially when it comes to like a class system where these people are just like yanked out of their sort of hibernation to work.
But like, the question again. For me is like, why would they choose to do it that way? Like, what is the benefit of coming back? You know, that's never really explored. What is, so this woman had been in a previous triad. And I guess my other thing is, I guess every single triad, navigation triad, is romantic. It's like a marriage. They're like romantically and sexually involved, which is not really, I don't know. I mean, I guess, sure. it is one way to explore like gender and sexuality within a novel. And I guess, you know, kudos to Delaney for doing this in 1966. But it doesn't really like totally make sense to me as to why that would be necessary. Well, but but anyway, that's different from the question I have right now, which is, so she was in that, she was in a previous triad and both of her previous partners were killed. And she chose to, you know, do this discorporation situation or whatever it happens to be, where she essentially died by suicide, but mm-hmm. her consciousness was uploaded and her body was preserved. So like, my question is, why would you do that? But is it because you think that maybe one day you do want to come back?
I think so. Yes.
Okay.
That was my...
You just want to be dead for a while?
Well, like, I mean, it's hard because for her, I think it was because, like, okay, she was in her triple. They died. She couldn't go on. So she killed herself.
Right.
But she has to be part of a triple, right? Like, that's like, I guess everybody just has jobs that they do, like that's who they are as their job. So if somebody brought her back to be in another triple, she would be cool with it because now she gets in another triple.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like that could have been explored more.
Now,
I was just like, what are the benefits? know? Is the benefit literally just I have to go work for somebody else, like more or less against my will again? Because that doesn't really make sense to me. But
I mean, well, and Rydra did ask her, like, are you cool with this? And she was like, yes, which again is kind of okay. I mean, I think it's like an interesting concept. Like you can have these romantic feelings towards people based on nothing or seeing them or based on somebody else telling you, like, that's fine. As long as that's sort of explained to me as a part of what their sexuality is.
Right.
Whereas in a book that's so very different from how we think of it, that it kind of needs a bit of explanation, or else like you're using the same words that we use. But if it means something different to these people, can I know what it means? Like, because I would like to explore that. I would really like to understand, why do they need three people to navigate the ship? What does navigating the ship mean?
Right.
What are they physically doing? What are the action items?
It's also funny because I was confused and I thought that the ear, the nose, and the eyes were them, that other group of three. I thought they were the same group of three, essentially, because
I did too.
It seemed to me, these people who were sensing the different places, I thought that they were the navigators. I thought they were using those senses to tell everybody where to go, but they're
not. That's the other thing, too, is they're just telling people. So the navigators are pointing the ship in a direction, but the ear, eye, and nose are saying whether we're actually going in that direction or not.
Okay.
Is that what it is? I mean, I don't, it doesn't make sense to me.
I don't know. It seemed to me like, okay, so they're sensing different things. Like there's a point where like Rydra puts on this suit that allows her to experience the sensations that they just kind of like gather innately. And so she's, you know, she smells something and someone tells her where it is and like what it's from. And then she can feel, you know, like she hears something else and they tell her that. And then she uses those senses to decide, okay, that's where we want to go next. And so I don't know. I mean, I guess that can be separate. Some people sense the different things that might tell you where you want to go. And then the navigators point you in that direction. I guess that's possible. That makes sense, I guess.
And then there's also a pilot, Brass.
Yes.
And what is the pilot doing? Physically steering? The other problem I have is when they are in the ship and when Rydra is like telling people commands and talking about where they're going, what they're going to do, I don't know where they are. Like, there's no real explanation given other than they sit on air-filled bubble chairs.
That's, like, so incredible that, like, for 1966, like, the idea of, like, interior design was the inflatable chair that I had in my bedroom in fourth grade.
But, like, all I can think of when they're saying that is this, like, spaceship looking interior with nothing, just like smooth silver walls.
I know.
With bubble chairs, because I'm not getting anything else. I know. Is there a steering wheel? Are they like typing on a pad? I don't know. I'm getting no sense of like what the environment looks like. Do the bubble
chairs have joysticks coming out of the armrests?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was, it was funny because I told you about this earlier, but there would be points where like I was assuming that people were standing like in a hallway or the brig or whatever it is. All these words that hallway is not a word I know from Star Trek, but brig maybe is. I don't know. All of these different places that like I can imagine from like having been around while Josh is watching Star Trek, you know, like these different parts of a ship. And then I'll assume that everybody is standing and talking or maybe like working at their stations or whatever and talking. But then it'll be like she was in a sled and then she zoomed away on the sled. What is happening? She was on a sled the whole time.
I know.
Or the sled was here. Where are they? What does the sled do? How does it get her around? They also can travel on saucers, which I imagined to be like Roombas, but you wouldn't find out that they were on saucers until she's like gliding off on one.
That's the oddest way that one of the oddest things about the writing is there's no transitions between what somebody is doing. They are in one scene and then they are in another scene. And there's no indication that they went somewhere else until after you get them like actively doing something that wouldn't be possible on the ship. You know what I mean? Like zooming around in the saucers. It's like things happen after the fact. Like I have an example. This is when Rydra is at the Barons and she says, okay, this is not really, we don't have to talk about the story part of it, but just the writing. She went through the double doors and started down the staircase. I saw you go out and I thought I'd wait for you to come back in. Deja vu, she thought, but she couldn't have seen him before in her life. Blue-black hair over a face craggy but in its late 20s. He stepped back to make way for her on the stairway with an incredible economy of movement. So she's going down the staircase. All of a sudden you get these quotation marks that somebody is speaking, but she's alone up until this point.
Yeah.
And then you get deja vu, she thought. She couldn't have seen him before. So you think, is there a person there? Is she thinking about somebody else? Like, what is happening? And then you finally get, he stepped back for her on the stairway. So it's such a, it feels like these pieces are not in the right order.
I know. I wound up having to go back and reread a lot in this to the point where, like, I found actually reading the book really frustrating. So then I was listening to the audiobook, and I think I listened to parts of, like, probably listened to the majority of this audiobook twice to actually know what was happening. And I think part of it is it's just a different experience of reading, and I think there must be other people for whom, like, this kind of afterwards description doesn't totally throw what they're expecting or like what they think they're reading into like a total tailspin like it does to me. I know a lot of people complain about how much stuff is described or whatever. I do need some description. Obviously it's something that I find very important. Some people don't need that. I do find it really difficult. I don't know, maybe for some people what you're imagining and then getting new, like completely new, very important information that totally changes what you must have been imagining, they must be able to incorporate that a lot faster than I can. I don't know. I really struggled with that. I really struggled with having a mental image of something and then finding out that it's 1,000% different, like at the end of a chapter, you know, and then yeah. me having to like recontextualize all of it. So
I think yeah. too, I've thought this before, and I think for me, it's mainly comes in genre fiction where there's an assumption. The reader is just supposed to assume a lot of things or sort of fill in the blanks mm-hmm. and not in a like, oh, this is open to your interpretation ending, but with actual like physical things, the environment, what people look like, where they're going, how they're yeah. getting to one place or the other. And I think that it's possible a lot of readers can just do that. Like they just, if it's not stated, like I don't understand how Rydro's poetry is getting to the invaders.
Right.
What yeah, is the,
it's everywhere.
Who is publishing this? How, you know, how are they doing
this? How is
this?
It distributed? Like, yeah.
Literally, how is it distributed? And for a lot of people, and they would just say, what does it matter? Like, mm-hmm. why are you even thinking about that? I don't even think about that stuff. And mm-hmm. that's fine. But like, it stops me in my tracks, because if I'm trying to believe in this world, if I'm trying to immerse myself in it, I don't want to be told these are the invaders. They're trying to kill everyone. And our people, our heroes, are trying desperately to figure out where they're going to attack next so they can save lives. Oh, yeah. Also, the invaders read poetry. Well, yeah. Now I don't know if I want the invaders to die or not. Like, maybe I want to be on their side. Like, I don't know anything about them.
Yeah, I think this is a problem I have more broadly with like science fiction and fantasy in general, is especially like over the last decade, there's been so much talk about world building and how wonderful, you know, these different authors do world building. And I read them and I go, I don't know that I understand what everyone is calling world building. Is world building, in the case of this book, the fact that we've got like, you know, a different way of navigating spaceships than maybe I am familiar with having seen in science fiction? And then also like the idea of this underground world where people wrestle in order to show that they would be a good pilot, or, you know, a world where thruples like exist and it's kind of unusual, but like there is a community in which that's really like accepted and that's important, right? Like, is that mm-hmm. the idea of world building? Because like, to some extent, sure, but like, to me, there's not a whole lot explaining how any of that operates, which I would assume would be part of world building. And then also, there's no description of any of it, which I find necessary for world building.
I mean, this is also, yeah. I think, a fight I have with people, because people hate exposition.
I know.
And
yeah.
obviously, sometimes it can be done badly and awkwardly. Right. But a lot of times, I like it. I don't care if it's like presented as, now Rydra opens up a codex where it explains, you know, what triples do, or like yeah. the discorporate, like, and then she reads about it. Like, I don't mind that kind
of
stuff.
Well, I find it confusing too, because like there was the perfect opportunity to explain it to that third person when she was dragging around the customs yeah. person, you know, and that would have been, you know, a great opportunity. But instead, like, while all of that could be happening, he's being like seduced by a succubus, you know, which is like, sure, that can also be world building.
I mean,
you know,
that's
that yeah. does exist in this world. But like, yeah, I was just like, I think like there's a few more for me, like concrete operational things that you could have had explained to this guy. That would have made me feel a little more grounded here.
Well, that, and it sort of felt like we spent a lot of time on people who weren't really important in the long run.
Right.
So we spend time with that customs guy. And the succubus thing was really interesting. Like, I mm-hmm. did actually like that part. I wish it meant something in the broader sense, or gave me a sense of the world. I mean, I guess it kind of gave me the sense of that neighborhood. But
yeah.
Or like the general. Like, we start out with the general realizing he's instantly falling in love with Rydra.
Yeah.
What was the purpose of that?
I don't know.
It seemed to be just to say, hey, guess what? Not only is Rydra smart, she's also super, super hot.
Hot, or, you know, like, so charming or charismatic or something. Yeah, something that, like, causes men to fall in love with her.
And then she's 26 and she is flattered that the general fell in love with her. And I know Delaney is gay, but still, this is like a man writing a woman. Like, I'm sorry, but the general's like in his 50s, I think.
She's not just flattered, but she's like, when I come back, I promise I'll still really like you.
Yeah.
What?
I mean, come on.
Especially because she goes on to fall in love with somebody else. But to talk about something that I did actually like, even though I don't know why they were there at all, was the scenes with the at the Baron's like place where they have the big dinner that I thought was I thought that was a fun set piece. The Baron's wife, even though the writing about the Baron's wife was atrocious in terms of like how we're dealing with her body, she as a character was fun. She was like there, she was down to party, she said some of the dumbest shit I've ever heard a character say in terms of like being open-minded, but it was still fun. Like There's just like one guy from the crew who was like, I want to have the biggest drink. And, you know, if you don't like the sandwiches with anchovies, then tell the caterer not to make them. And then she's like, I never thought of that. I should have the biggest drink. And I should tell them not to make those sandwiches. And she's like, I'm so glad you brought him because I never would have thought of those things before. But otherwise, no. I thought she was fun. She was like, all these people you're going to think are super boring, I'll show you the like cool people, important people. And then like, check out my cool enormous dining table that like automatically changes the courses for us, you know.
I did think that was
Hogwarts
cool.
Eat your heart out. Yeah.
I think that that's another trope I enjoy is dinner. Big dinner scenes are always fun. We got a little bit of description. I think there were peacocks on the table.
Yeah, I think that was the most. But especially once shit starts to go wrong and like her little control panel is screwed up, you get like a lot of description of like the giant flagons of wine like overflowing and you know, things flipping over on the tables.
And that's what I would call world building. Right?
Like, same. I know.
Actually,
you're filling this world. You're populating the world.
We understand how these people eat. We also understand the decadence of what they're doing here. We even understand, I do think the way she's described was fat phobic, probably, but
incredibly.
We are understanding like what they look like, how they deal with their, you know, servants. So I think that was a really good one. And then, of course, like something big happens and I didn't totally understand what was going on.
Or why. Yeah. I don't know. Was that the invaders who did that?
No, that was the TW-55.
Oh.
The Baron's like creation.
Okay.
So the thing that I read earlier, that was because the Baron shows Rydra. That creation. I think it's TW-55.
I believe so, yep.
And then when she says, when somebody said, that guy says something to her in the stairwell and she says, deja vu, but I've never seen him before. She had seen him before. It was
TW-55. Yeah. Gotcha. But this is happening concurrently with the invaders planning an attack because she warns him. Okay.
And what I still don't understand, well, I think maybe I do. Well, yes, never mind. I do. Sorry. They take off without a pilot or without coordinates or something. Or somebody else makes them take off. And it's that one guy. I can't remember his name.
Ooh, Brass?
The criminal. No.
Oh.
Brass is the pilot.
He's got a name that's like the Beast. The Butcher. Butcher. Yeah.
Butcher. Yeah. And just for a second, we gotta like scroll back to Brass. Who is he? Because he fought against the dragon when she went to pick him up in the underground. Is he also, he's yellow and fuzzy.
He's the one that's 10 feet tall and it has feet like a saber-toothed tiger and like a face like a saber-toothed tiger or something.
Is that necessary to piloting?
No, I don't think so. I think those are just all body modifications he made with cosmetic surgery.
And then The other guy, the slug, what does he even do?
I don't know.
She had to pick him up. Okay, that's all. Anyway, we don't have to go back that far.
I got almost all of them confused constantly because I was never quite clear what any of them were doing or why. So,
yeah.
And what their names were. Because who was Callie? There was someone named Callie.
That
too,
was that's the one who you were just talking about who talked to the Baron's wife. He was one of the triple.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Anyway, whatever.
So do we want to sort of pivot and talk about the words, the kind of the discussion of language that's in there? Yeah. And then we can talk about the end because it does have to do with language.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I thought was interesting is Rydra talks about phonemic and allophonic distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
And how, like, the general, nobody, like, realized Babel 17 was a language. And this is something that I guess I know, but I forget about, is, okay, R and L in many Eastern languages are allophones, considered the same sound, written and heard the same, just this, like, the T at the beginning of they and at the beginning of theater. And those are two different sounds. But I never think about it that way.
Right.
Like, either, like, ether and either.
Yeah.
It's just, like, a fun thing that I am like, oh, yeah.
I know. And it's one of those things that if I keep trying to hear the difference, I can't hear it anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and she talks about different languages. And this is, I think we talked about it a little bit before, maybe in, like, the last episode, which was also sort of about language. The book we read was also sort of about language anyway, but that it's based off of this kind of idea of linguistic relativity, which is what the Sapir-Whorf, what is it? Is it Sapir-Whorf?
Sapir-Whorf. Yeah.
Sapir-Whorf. Hypothesis about language, which is that in some ways, like, the language that you have shapes your brain, I guess, mm-hmm. is one way to put it. And it shapes who you are because the language that you need to have language in order to have thoughts. And so the language you have dictates the type of thought you can create in a way, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, it's more or less debunked, right?
Well, I mean, I think it's like, I guess I think that it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Because I think people tend to think, oh, right, well, that's why the United States is so violent, is because we have a lot of words for violence or whatever.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And that's like, there's a lot more going into that than just right. something that simple, you know? But I think it's kind of like, I think that it's still sort of, I don't know. It can be combined in other theories, I think.
Right.
But I don't really know. But it's definitely not like, yes, this is absolutely true, you know?
Right, right. And so this is an important theme in this book. And also I did want to throw out, aside from Present Tense Machine, which we just read, which was also sort of about the idea of, like, when did people become people? Was it when we got language or whatever? Which is, I would say, obviously a very related topic. Can you name the other book that we read that I believe even talked about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis?
Oh my gosh, I don't know.
It was The Idiot. Our very first book.
Our very first one. That's why we liked it so much.
Anyway,
our first time,
so,
but yeah,
this was obviously a really important, like, maybe the most important part of this book is that, you know, as she learns Babel 17, it changes her brain. She's able to think in much faster kind of layered ways because each little bit of Babel 17, each word or whatever it happens to be, a phoneme, whatever, carries so much information within it. And you can manipulate them to carry, you know, so much more information within it that, like, it expands her brain kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And as she falls in love with the butcher, who has this memory loss, she figures out that his language doesn't have you and I, and they do a whole long thing about trying to teach him you and I and what that would mean and what significance there is.
Let me just say, that whole conversation, it was pages and pages long. And yes, there's times when the full paragraph that one of them is speaking is using I when they mean you.
You. Yep.
And it was very, very difficult.
Yes.
To get through, and to, because you have to sort of read and constantly remind yourself.
That's why that they... it was very hard to listen to this as an audiobook.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
almost impossible. Yeah. I had to pull out like the book for those parts to go back and read it after she says, you've been using these, you know, you've been using I for me and me for you, or whatever. I for you and you for I. And then I had to go back through and like reread the whole friggin' thing several times.
I mean, so should we just say, so Butcher is the one who's been like organizing everything.
Yeah.
He's the one that made their plane take off before,
yes,
after the Baron's dinner.
Right.
And so part of it is because the word for alliance, who Rydra is in the general and all them, they're the alliance.
Yeah.
In Babel 17 translates literally as one who has invaded.
Right. So the alliance is the invaders to which, the invaders.
Which means they have to invade. If you speak Babel 17, you must invade. Essentially.
Right.
Or you must destroy the alliance.
Like, she explains it as like, you, if you have a language that only, like, the only language you have is about, like, tools and building things or whatever, and you left this person on another planet, it wouldn't be that crazy that they turned out to be a mechanic, is the idea that she mm-hmm. has, right? So, like, yeah. But it also turns out, yeah, that Butcher's language, original language that he didn't remember, he knew was Babel 17 because he is an earlier version of the TW-55, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And he was supposed to be a spy.
Right. But,
and then
we didn't talk about this either, but there has been some sabotage happening on Rydra's ship. And it turns out that it was her the whole time because she was learning Babel 17. And so it, you know, made her unknowingly have to sabotage the ship because she was learning about it. And so it turned her into a spy on her own ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which honestly, like, that's really interesting. All of that. I actually really loved that whole idea.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is getting into this book, I thought it was going to be more like detective work, trying to figure out how to translate Babel 17. And that would have been good. She slowly is finding out, like, well, where was I? You know, how come I'm the only one who was unaccounted for during the time of the sabotage?
Instead, there's like 40 pages of her doing this, you know, semi-romantic chat about you and I. And then at the end, it's like 30 pages of, well, here's what happened.
Yeah.
Instead of like showing you any of it. Yeah.
And also, I got to talk about this. So Butcher, when she first meets him on the pirate ship, he's only got like a loincloth on.
Yeah.
And then at some point it says that he dispensed with the loincloth.
And just has a holster, right?
So is he been naked the whole time?
I guess so.
Since then?
Yeah.
Which
I think is this, it's a, okay, because the themes of communication run throughout, right? So like, I think the idea with like the naked stuff, like when they go to the underground, everyone takes off their clothes. They have to. It's like how you operate in the underground. And part of it, I think, is this idea of like another way to communicate with everybody. You know, part like when she goes to pick up Brass and watch him wrestle, she's watching him wrestle and knows that he will be a good pilot because of the way he wrestles. So like, these are different ways that we can communicate with each other. You know, like being naked shows your body and shows your truth or whatever kind of thing. And so I wonder if that was part of that for him being naked, or if it was just
about, I think you're right,
being sexy and naked or something.
And I don't, and again, like, I don't mind. I think that is interesting. And like what you said about taking your clothes off in the underground, I think I just didn't get enough of the reasons why. Because again, it feels like I'm supposed to be filling in these blanks. And when they're not filled in, when I'm just told, first of all, a loincloth is like kind of inherently funny. Okay. And then when I'm told he takes it off.
And that is because our understanding of loincloths in, you know, American culture is just Tarzan.
Yes.
Only Tarzan.
And then you say he takes it off and he's only got a holster with a gun on it. Which, that's like comedic.
That is really funny because the idea that a loincloth would be covering a holster with a gun in it, like the tiniest scrap of fabric you can imagine.
And that's another thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not even thinking of the right kind of loincloth. Is it more like a skirt, which would make a lot more sense? I don't know. How warm is it? Don't they go out in the in space at some point? And they're like, oh, well, might as well not put on a spacesuit. I was like, hold on a second. What is going on? But yeah, I don't know. There was another interesting thing. This is really short, but they mention, and it's something that I never really thought about before, but when Rydro was trying to like explain something about this word in Babel 17 that means like a great circle,
mm-hmm.
she said it carries information right in the word, just like bus stop or foxhole carry information in English that ligare or literie, comparable words in French, lack. And I was like, I've never even thought about that. The fact that words have information in them. And that's part of Babel 17, too, is there's so much information in each word.
So can we talk about the end and what it means? Because this, I had to listen to it twice. They were able to change Babel 17 to be peaceful instead of warful. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So
and how did they do that then?
I believe they did it because of her telepathy.
Okay.
Because she has a stronger mind.
Okay.
And she was able to like, I don't know, they talk about like an antenna.
Uh-huh.
And so there's something about she was able to put out a signal okay. of some sort. And correct the language and change it.
Okay.
I guess. I don't know if that's completely correct, but that was what I am guessing.
Okay.
Because they, like, otherwise, they get, what like, was
captured by the Alliance, and the Alliance is like not sure what to do with them, and then they escape from the Alliance. And I was like, mm-hmm. oh, are they working for the invaders now? And then I was like, oh, no, she says the war is going to be over. So they made it. I don't know.
I think they just were like, they were going to get put on trial, but I think they knew that they wouldn't be found guilty, but they just mm-hmm. didn't want to do that.
Okay.
Maybe. Or maybe they had to go out and spread Babel 17 further. Like they were able to change the language in their own minds, but not for everybody else.
Okay, yeah.
It's a good question.
And was it just by introducing the idea of, like, you and I?
So that's what I got. But okay. I feel like it can't possibly be true, right?
Because there was also talk about, like, about Babel 17 basically being, like, a long time, like, evolution of, like, binary code. Like computer coding language, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, binary code just had on or off.
Yes.
Don't quote me on this. Computer nerds.
I don't
truly know what I'm talking about, but so yeah, so that it was just kind of like this really basic thing, and you can insert extra stuff into these codes in order to override these different things. So that must be what they were doing telepathically.
Sure.
Which is like, what a nice little, you know, escape hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, again, this book is, it does have some good scenes. The underground scene is fun. The dinner scene is fun. I think there's a lot of good concepts.
Yeah.
the Discorporate, I do wish, I think they were interesting. I wish we could have spent more time with them.
I hate to draw too many comparisons to this, between this and the Fifth Element. Not Fifth Element. I always do that. The fifth, what is it?
Season.
Fifth season. But because the fifth season also has triads, like polyamorous relationships, it's hard not to also do it. And also because like the fifth season is like one of the few kind of, I don't know, is that considered science fiction? I think we had this discussion in that episode. But one of the few types of books like of the genre that I have read as an adult, they do kind of overlap to me. But like that book and this book are very similar to me because it's just like a lot of people talking when I would be much more interested in exploring literally everything else that it tells me than just these people like arguing or falling in love or whatever it happens to be. It's the least interesting part to me.
It's very, very difficult to get through all of the dialogue. And a lot of it is just sort of people repeating what they said to each other in a different way. And I suppose that is teaching us a lesson about communication. But yeah, so I mean, this is like, obviously, if you are used to reading genre fiction written in this way, there's probably stuff here that you'll like. But if you're going into it like us, where we don't read a lot of this, honestly, I think most of my sci-fi is through like TV and movies.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times for me, it just works better because
that's the other thing I kept thinking about is I was like, are most sci-fi writers actually, is what they want to be doing writing screenplays? Because it's all dialogue and no description. And like, the dialogue is important and so are the plots, but like, I could use like a director in here to show me what everything else is.
Well, I mean, that's just the thing is like when they're talking, if it's a movie or TV show, you are seeing what the environment looks like.
Right.
So I think that's probably why I prefer sci-fi in visual media, because I don't have to wonder what anything looks like.
I don't have to rely on my stupid little brain to fill in all those gaps.
Yeah.
All right.
But
sorry,
but
everybody. I don't think I'm cool enough for the sci-fi club. Unless, having heard me whine about this for the last hour, you have a recommendation, then let us know.
Well, we're about to read The Dispossessed, so
yeah,
you're not getting away from it anytime soon.
Thanks for listening to The Bookstore.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
You can find all of the ways to contact us at thebookstorepodcast.com.
And our next book discussion will be The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becky Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye. Or whenever we get to this at our schedule.